shoulder pain, shoulder impingement, any type of issue involving a pinching in the shoulder. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about three different types of shoulder impingement, what the root cause of all of these things typically is, and then what we can do about it. All of that and more on today's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
You filmed some videos about shoulder impingement. We talked about it a little bit. We've never done an episode specifically on shoulder impingement. We did one on shoulder mobility and using the hips to try to get the volume changes and the pressure changes in order to affect the shoulder. So I wanted to kind of talk about the three shoulder impingements.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we start with that.
Mm-hmm. So like the typical representation, so you can kind of fall back on like traditional tests and such, like a Hawkins-Kennedy impingement, painful arc, or the impingement that occurs above shoulder level, which would be a NEARS test, I think. If you use those would be representations that we could use, and then basically we just have to say, okay, well, what is it? Because the like rotator cuff gets blamed for a lot of stuff. And those are results. Those are not the causative elements, because we've got a lot of thorax shape problems that create this. And this is why looking at shoulder in isolation really doesn't cut it, because what we end up with is a shape change in the thorax that creates a path that the extremity has to be able to follow.
Let's actually talk about what impingement is. Let's talk about like each test as it correlates to each impingement sign, what they think they're seeing or diagnosing, mm-hmm. and maybe what is actually, you sort of talked about what's actually happening with the lack of space as we're trying
right.
to.
Right. It is. Yeah. It's literally a lack of access to space. Right. So I have to, so if I move my arm into a straight line path, so as I move through that path, I have to be able to superimpose IR on ER, as I'm moving the shoulder through that excursion. Any lack of either in that circumstance reduces the amount of space that is actually available for the shoulder to be able to move through that space. Right. And so the thorax shape change is the greatest influence.
We're at very, very,
it's a lack reduced. Of space.
Yeah.
It's
lack
of space. It's a lack
that,
of space.
That feeling of pinching is from things not having enough space to move. So it just kind of that runs into an end.
Correct. So take the space that's available between humerus and the coracoacromial ligament and the acromion itself, and compress that space, because if you don't have it available in the thorax, I have to then rely on the next available space. And so what happens is if I compress the thorax and it does not change shape, then I am totally reliant on that space that is available within the shoulder joint itself, which exhausts very quickly.
Okay. And then let's talk about the three typical shoulder impingements and then the test that's associated with each, just so people have an idea. People coming into this, like clicking on it because they see something about shoulder pain, we're trying to speak to each of their sort of experiences and then put a name to it and then give people some better perspective on what they need to reconsider, maybe about what they've been told or what they've already heard about what's wrong with their shoulder. And like you had mentioned, people like to blame the shoulder when it's more about what lies beneath the shoulder.
Correct.
What allows for the shoulder motion to really happen in the first place. So let's go the three impingements, just go one by one, and we can talk about where each is, what the tests would tell you have it.
So if we go through the three tests
sure.
first, Okay. So like a Hawkins Kennedy, which is 90 degrees of elevation with internal rotation. So that has to be an access to internal rotation. I have to have that available prior to the test, which means that volume in the thorax has to be able to go from the lower part of the thorax into the upper part of the thorax for me to access that space. Because as I perform the test, I'm actually compressing the thorax in that circumstance. So if I never expanded before that test, then I'd never had the space to turn into internal rotation in the first place. That then exhausts the motion in the shoulder and creates the compressive strategy that would result in a symptom. Okay.
So it's as someone's reaching their elbow forward and they're internally rotating, the symptom that would occur would be like a pain in the front of the shoulder.
Typically, yeah. It's like an anterior to superior kind of a symptom.
And that is diagnosed as what?
It would just be referred to an impingement.
Like an anterior impingement?
I suppose you could qualify it that way.
Yeah. I mean, typically, I'm just trying to like put the names to these things that people have been told.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's your first... Hawkins Kennedy, anterior shoulder impingement, front of the shoulder to the top of the shoulder, kind of like this line that runs along the front of your deltoid.
Yeah. Like people will point to that spot, right?
Right.
And so then they'll get anything from like a biceps tendon issue to like, and then, or they'll call it like a rotator cuff impingement of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah, and they'll blame like a biceps tendonitis as the reason for why,
because it's anterior.
Yeah, because it connects to that spot, so that must be the reason. And I'm saying that with sarcasm. Okay, so let's go to number two. What would the second test that we're going to go through? So Hawkins Kennedy was the first one.
Painful arc.
Okay, and so explain what that looks like.
So traditionally, this would be arm elevation away from the body.
So like you're flapping your wings.
Sort of. Yeah. And that's going to be typically associated with the dorsal rostral compression. So this is compression between the area, between the shoulder blades. Once again, it's a lack of expansion prior to the execution of the test. So as I move my arm into that space, I have to have an expansion in that posterior area of the thorax before I access that space, because as I move through that space, that area then gets compressed. So the scapulae actually compress against the thorax in that circumstance, right? If it's already compressed, then I don't have the space available. And so once again, then I'm reliant on the remaining space available in the shoulder, which would be reduced in that circumstance. And so then you would get like a pain through this mid range, because what you'll see in the execution of it is like there's no pain, and then they go above that, and then it doesn't hurt anymore, right? And so that's called a painful arc.
Okay,
but it's indicative of where the compression is,
and that pain is typically on superior to the shoulder. It's like on top of the arm.
It'll be more like a superior lateral, and it'll be like a subacromial.
Yeah. So they would be talked about as like a subacromial impingement. And your acromion is like the little bone that like comes out of the shoulder blade that kind of reaches over the top of your. Yeah.
It's like if you look at the so-called archway at the top of the shoulder, you've got the acromion, the coracoacromial ligament that attaches to that, which attaches to the coracoid.
Right. And that's the, if anyone's had like an AC joint issue or something like that, that's what we're kind of talking about.
AC joint tends to be more of the elevated position, actually.
I'm mentioning that as a place way for people to understand the location.
Right. So clavicle, the lateral aspect of the clavicle meets the acromion. And so
AC joint would be like if I'm an outfielder and I dove to catch like a fly ball and I landed on my arm, that would be like an AC joint. You see that a lot in Frisbee too.
Yeah.
AC joint issues because of that tension with the arm being overhead. And a lot of times those people not possessing the space to put their arm in that position anyways. And then when they land on it, there's no give, there's no expansion, right, because it's such a compressed area already. Correct. Okay. So that's number two. That was the painful arc out to the side. When you're approaching like a 90 degree angle from the body, that's where you typically have that symptom. And yeah, it's going to be that superior lateral type of AC joint existing area. So we talked about the first one was kind of like the front of the shoulder, that this second one was sort of like lateral shoulder. And then the third one would be like a posterior.
What? We're not there yet. We want to go above shoulder level.
Okay. So the next test is the, which one?
I believe it's nears. It's been a long time since I even think about this. So. But you would do like an elevation with internal rotation.
So your thumb points down out in front of you, and then you raise your arm
and you elevate up. And it would be above shoulder level in that circumstance. And that's a lack of expansion in the posterior upper thorax. So again, we're just pushing volume up the thorax, and wherever those spaces are lacking, that results in the compression at the shoulder.
Yeah, and that location of the symptom is going to be where typically?
Tends to be anterior. And this is actually more of your like AC joint stuff would show up here too.
Okay. Gotcha.
When you're above shoulder level.
The fourth, so I guess the fourth impingement would be the posterior now?
Yeah, so like people always come in and they'll go, it hurts right there.
Right.
Right, yeah. And that's a scenario where you have magnified the ER at the shoulder, and so you get pressure on the posterior aspect of the shoulder.
And that you typically test for with what, or does it just come about?
Actually, you just put them in the ER position of the shoulder in most cases.
So field goal position.
Okay. Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So we've actually talked about four impingements.
Yeah, there's three. There's the three primary, and then the posterior one. Yeah.
And the posterior one. So the order of those. So let's kind of talk about. You've kind of gone back in and out of talking about the root causes of each.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, these things are blamed on certain muscles being tight, other muscles being weak.
Yeah.
The certain tendons being too tight and being inflamed and needing to be released, or spaces that need to be expanded, things need to be cut and shaved down or moved. But we're asking everyone to reconsider that. Maybe it really isn't about the shoulder. It's more about what is supporting the shoulder or what is.
Well, the shoulder responds. Okay.
Sure. So you have a shoulder result.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So when I have these compressive strategies in the thorax, we have an increase in muscle activity, right? And so you will see an increase in the muscle activity that would be associated with the rotator cuff muscles. Like you will see concentric orientation in that circumstance, which increases pressure in the muscle, which reduces the nutrition to the tendon, which is why we start to see the tendinopathies show up in that circumstance, right? And so it's not that there isn't a response to this, but we have to look at it from a causative. If we just looked at the rotator cuff muscles, then we're falling short of this larger picture as to what these influences are. Because once we restore a lot of the thorax shaping capability. So this is being able to move air into different areas of the thorax. We would see a reduction in that muscle activity that would be associated directly with the shoulder. And then this is where we see improvements in shoulder movement excursion and a reduction of symptoms very quickly in many circumstances. Because we're getting this down regulation of the muscle activity. Because if I don't have the foundational structure, I have to look at more focal local strategies as far as controlling the position of the shoulder. And the easiest way to control it is to ramp up that muscle activity and then reduce the amount of motion that you do have available.
Right, which is why there can be symptomatic relief from doing your traditional strength training of the rotator cuff for some people.
And that for some people,
Certainly. Yeah, depending on, and I kind of wanted to talk about that a little bit. So if there is like, there we have, we all take these, depending on archetype, we all kind of take these compensatory sequences. We all kind of fall through these compensatory sequences. The sequencing of how we compensate against gravity will manifest in similar ways in the shoulder pathologies, right? So it's like,
correct,
there will be an order to them. Mm-hmm. And then however far you are along the line of the order of shoulder compensations, the less, I would say, the less your traditional strength training stuff will work.
Right. So if you responded favorably to the traditional ER, IR kind of rubber band exercises that are often provided, if you can create relative movement between the humerus and the scapula in those circumstances, you can actually be successful with it. The problem that you run into, and again, this is the increase in the muscle activity and the reduction of that relative motion between the scapula and humerus. Now the scapula and the humerus start moving together as one, and then you would be much less successful with those traditional activities. And so it's all dependent on where you are in the compensatory process. The greater the magnitude of compensation, the less likely you are to respond to something that would be performed more in an isolated manner.
Yeah, because you're adding another layer of compression on top of,
correct,
the already provided layer of compression. And then eventually, yeah, you compress everything starts moving together, and you may have symptomatic relief. This is pretty much the pain conversation and the treatment and intervention conversation with any joint, really. Mm-hmm. It's
correct.
We've talked about it at the knee too. It's there. You keep adding compression. You do your band exercises, you do your face pulls, you do your band pull aparts, you do your serratus activities, all these things that are being prescribed to you. Mm-hmm. You just keep squeezing the thorax. You lock the humerus and the scapula together in one piece. They start to move in one piece. You're increasing the probability of some other level of compensation to happen. So that might, right, be an elbow thing. That might be a neck thing. That might be a just moving of the shoulder symptom. That might be where you end up with a posterior shoulder impingement. Uh-huh. Because you've just compressed everything as hard as, correct, possible. Everything is twisted into that ER orientation. And then you run out of space in the back. And that's where, right, that pinches.
Right.
So what we're trying to offer is trying to understand that a lot of times you have this compression coming from somewhere. The volume and pressure shift is being stopped at a certain point when it tries to fill up the shoulder. Mm-hmm. But that compression, those sort of like parking brakes, if you will, need to be alleviated a lot of times through manual techniques or self-applied massage techniques or self-applied mechanical techniques, whatever you want to try to do, because we have to down, like you had mentioned, down-regulate, turn down muscle tone, yep, get that stuff out of the way first to allow for that expansion to occur below.
That's correct. Yes.
And in order to do that, I think just referring back to our episode on shoulder mobility, I think we talked about a lot of things that help with that. And we obviously can't get too far into all these different manual techniques for the shoulder. I guess since we've sort of talked about the bottom up pressure gradient, creating, uh-huh, the volume shift and the working on the pelvis first in order to kind of, mm-hmm, reflect and move the wave,
correct,
up to the thorax.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we talk about just some basic stuff about, because people can use, anyone listening to this can use a tennis ball, can use a foam roller, can use a TheraBar to try to move some compression around, try to alleviate, uh-huh, some compression in the shoulder. So, mm-hmm, maybe we talk about some big bang things that people can try.
Well, if you think about this systemically.
Yeah.
Right. One of the issues that's associated with a thorax compression is a gradient, a pressure gradient that goes downward, which is why we, even in a scenario where somebody comes in and their entire symptom is shoulder related, we have to look at this systemically, because the way that we the way that we resist this top-down gradient is with bottom-up pressure, and then that's associated with the shape and position of the pelvis, the ground contacts that would be associated with lower extremity. Because if I can resist this top-down gradient, I maintain the expansion in the thorax. People don't realize that it's actually air on the inside of you that holds your thorax up and allows this expansion to occur that would be indicative of having access to relative motions in the shoulder, right? So, you know, if you started with something simple like a hook lying position where you have grounded feet, you have a grounded pelvis, and then you can actually orient the upper extremity to influence the thorax shape and position. So if I ER the shoulder with the upper extremity elevated, I can actually expand that anterior thorax, which actually allows the access to the internal rotation in that circumstance, right? So that's a full system behavior that helps shape that thorax and maintain the expansion. So something along those lines, prior to something that would be more isolative. So I reestablish relative motion in the shoulder, and then and as I do these isolated exercises, I get relative motion between the scapula and the humerus. I get relative motion between the scapula and the thorax, and then that's typically what resolves a lot of the symptoms, depending on how far along somebody is in their process. So we want to think about this not as an isolative behavior. It's an isolated result, but we have to think about this systemically.
Yeah, I was referring more to like using tennis balls and TheraBars and what people can do.
So, well, so you could get symptomatic relief by working directly around the shoulder. So you've got this exposure posteriorly of the scapula. So we'll use infraspinatus as a target. If I have a scenario where I have an increased concentric orientation in that circumstance, where that's reducing the relative motion between the scapula and the humerus, I can actually use something that's focal local, use like a lacrosse ball because it's small, and I can apply pressure to that muscle and actually downregulate the behavior there. I could use something similar on the anterior aspect of the thorax, because the anterior compression would be associated with, say, pec major and then some of pec minor, which is actually attached to the acromion, which influences the shoulder position. And so I can actually alleviate that there. And I, again, get symptomatic relief and actually recapture some measure of the relative motion.
I think just generally speaking, and this isn't going to be the case for everyone, and having someone that can help you assess where you're at in this compensatory sequence would be best. But understanding that two of the things that you're trying to look for based on where you're at in the compensatory sequence are going to be trying to get the humerus away from the scapula and then trying to get the scapula away from like your spine, and the creating space so that the scapula and then the humerus can move separately from each other, and they're not kind of being dragged in one piece or being like stapled to
or your compressed body. Thorax.
So the things that we end up doing with a lot would be like the pec, like make sure getting the pec to calm down so that the humerus can start to move away, getting the space between the spine and the medial aspect of the
shoulder blade. You look at the spinoscapular muscles, especially in scenarios where that scapula is moving closer and closer to the spine, getting more compressed to the thorax. So that again, we rely on that for that painful arc. That space is typically going to be compressed if I have the painful arc, and so that can alleviate that. When you think about the Hawkins Kennedy, the first space that you need available is actually the space below the scapula on that posterior aspect of the rib cage, right? So I can affect that. And typically, we can use a foam roller in that space because it's a little bit bigger, right? Certain upper extremity activities that would be associated with reaching can alleviate some of the upper portion of that posterior thorax space. We make that space available, and that allows us access to it without the compressive strategy in the shoulder.
Yeah. So in a general sense, trying to roll your pecs and rolling them in such a way where like you're getting the space to go towards the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And then rolling your upper back between the shoulder blades and the spine to try to get the scapula to get away from the spine.
Correct.
And then once you've alleviated that top down squeeze, you can try to use like a foam roller along the backside of your rib cage and just trying to push volume up into that now unrestricted or unconstrained space. Correct. At least hopefully. There are so many other factors, right? You can have like a coracobrachialis that's really concentric. You can have a biceps that's really concentric. You can have Teres muscles that are really concentric that are just pulling the shoulder blade into like a funky position. So even if you do alleviate the pec and the upper back, you still have this sort of compensated position of the shoulder
blade. Right. It's an anti-orientation of the entire thorax.
Yeah. But the things that we're saying could be something to try. They're not going to be a solution for everyone. But if I can alleviate compression from my pecs, if I can alleviate upper back compression, and then I can kind of coax the volume upwards in the thorax by, so those, again, I'll repeat what we talked about. We talked about rolling the pecs with like a lacrosse ball, rolling the upper back muscles between the shoulder blades with a lacrosse ball, and then taking a foam roller on the lower part of your rib cage and just slowly letting air and volume go upwards through the rib cage.
Yeah. So you make a space and then you encourage volume into that space.
Right. And then I would refer to what we talked about in the shoulder mobility episode. I think we went through an entire series of exercises and activities for that. And then what Bill had mentioned a little bit earlier, he kind of jumped ahead, was talking about like an arm bar sort of scenario where you would be able to play with the extremity position of the upper body to bias the airflow under load. So we would call that in the UHPC model, like strategic resistance.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Great. I think that was useful. So when you were a kid, do you remember like, let's say like when you were 10, what were like the posters? What were the posters that you had hanging in your bedroom?
Okay. Wow. This is going to be interesting.
I'm sure it changes. Everyone hits a point in like pre-puberty and puberty where things.
Oh, there was a big transition.
I'm talking about 10 years old.
I remember. So 10 years old, I remember I had a Star Wars poster, at one point. And then then it transitioned into, a series of females.
Yeah.
That my mom was just thrilled about. Yeah.
Do you remember which ones?
Oh yeah, I do. Lonnie Anderson.
Okay.
Cheryl Teagues. And what was the third one? Heather Thomas. I think Heather Thomas. That was post 10 years old though.
Yeah. This now everyone knows that Bill is like 70 years old.
I think I had a Superman poster at one point as well.
Yeah, I had a Batman poster forever, and like I think Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Pokemon, probably Star Wars, Simpsons, and then when I was like in high school was when they had. Do you remember all of those liquor ads? Like the Absolute ads, it would be like bottle. You would just cut them out of magazines. Uh-huh. And then I just had all of those like made into collages and stuff around my room.
I had a Bubba Smith light beer poster. I think I got it for free from
Bubba Smith.
My dad probably got it from a distributor at one point, and I had that up on the wall too.
Because
he was tearing the can open.
Yeah, so post in the comments what your posters were when you were like 10 years old.